All right, so I was leaving a voicemail for Trita Parsi. I got written right here on my piece of paper. Trita. You know why? Because I wanted to interview him about a thing that he wrote. Well, I'm way behind. Yeah, I left a couple other messages too. I figured out why I can't reach Gareth Porter. It's because he's on the road. Giving speeches, you know, lectures, talks at bookstores and places about his book. And I can't even get a hold of the guy. Even if he can't do any more interviews this week, I sure would like to be able to tell you where you can go and see him talk. I know he's going to be in Boston, and he's going to be in something, and then he's going to San Francisco, and he's going some other places to give talks about his books. So I don't have any idea how you can find out exactly. But anyway, I'm trying to reach him. I want to finish up my interview of Gareth. My very long 8-9-part interview now, something like that, with Gareth about his book Manufactured Crisis. Boy, it's a good time. The Untold History of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Anyway, so we're almost done, really. We just got to talk about Parchin, and we got to talk about the fake war threat. And we've got to wrap it up, and then we're done. I think the Parchin story, that's going to be a whole interview. And then we're going to wrap it up at the end with the fake war threat and the epilogue. But, anyway. So that could be today. If I hear back from Gareth in time, if he has the time today, I'll try to work that out for you. Otherwise, what's going to happen is Nathaniel Ferguson is going to get himself interviewed here. Texas Public Policy Action, Right on Crime. Here's how bad the police state has gotten in America. And also, here's how much of a Democrat the current occupant of the White House is. That there is actually a conservative movement by even prominent Republican politicians getting on board with this thing for criminal justice reform. For rolling back the drug war, sort of, kind of, certainly in terms of penalties, mandatory minimums, some of these kinds of things. Shorter sentences, especially like on drug war issues, encouraging, you know, rehab and probation over prison time and that kind of stuff, which is still horrible, but anyway. It's gotten so bad that even right-wingers are saying, geez, man, we're sort of like our local sheriff's department is waging war against the people of our local township here. But I thought you guys were supposed to be the security force. I wasn't supposed to have to worry about you taking me away. I'm not breaking into anybody's house. I'm not defrauding any elderly people. What are you messing with me for? Say all the people who, you know, believed that the police were there to protect them for some reason. Anyway, so I mentioned on the show to you, Bernie Kerik, I don't know if he counts as a conservative. He's certainly some kind of right winger. But anyway, he was the police commissioner of New York. And, you know, Giuliani's Smithers. And he went to prison, which just goes to show you how criminal he was. Holy crap. His mob connections were so blatant that they couldn't help. Either that, or maybe he had personally insulted someone at the Department of Justice or something. I don't know what happened. I don't know. I can't explain how the law was applied to Bernie Kerik. Somehow, this guy who almost became the head of Homeland Security, literally, almost became the director of Homeland Security, ended up going to the federal pen. But then when he got out of the pen, I read this a week and a half ago. He got out of the pen and said, wow, there are good people in there who don't belong in there. What is going on here? How did it become like this? And he says, I'm the former police commissioner. I'm the guy who put these people in here. But now I'm looking at him and I'm going, whoa, really? This guy? This is who the laws are being enforced against. Regular people who aren't criminals at all, who didn't do anything at all, who didn't commit any crime at all, who at worst are guilty of some offense against some social engineering project, some regulation dreamt up by some conservative or liberal activist about how better to boss everyone else around. But otherwise, they're not criminals. They didn't do anything. And so, I mean, that's what it takes, right? You got to lock Bernie Kerik up in there with the rest of them for him to realize that. But he did. And apparently he's joined up with this movement now. And I got to tell you, and I'm a broken record later on in the show when I say this very same stuff to my guest. I think it is so important that on issues like this, the people pushing for, you know, quote-unquote reform, ultimately as much abolition as we can get is what we're really after here. That's what I'm really after, you know, abolishing the state altogether. But we can start with its very worst aspects, like its wars and its criminal justice system, as they call it. And the best way to accomplish both of those things, really, is to attack them from the right. You need, you know, think about in 2003 when we had the giant protests in every capital city all across the world and all across America, and there were tens of thousands on February 15th and March 15th, 2003. Huge protests in downtown Austin, 50,000, 60,000 people marching. And I remember one guy, I think it was, I don't know if it was the February or the March, I think it was the March. One of the speakers gave a speech that sounded like he'd been reading the American Conservative and Antiwar.com rather than was just a Democrat. He was calling them the war party, and he was talking about Israel, and he was talking about things that at that time, you know, most Democrats' position was, oh, this is just a corporate, you know, no blood for oil kind of a war, and they didn't know what a neocon was. They didn't realize there were different kinds of Republicans with, you know, different divergent agendas. But anyway, there was very little of that. But think of what if at all of those protests across the country, every anti-war right winger and especially anti-war veteran had put aside their distaste for a bunch of Jane Fonda loving hippie commies who were certain to be there, and had gone ahead and dressed up in their camouflage and got out their American flag and went and protested with them against the war. And what if their signs had all said anti-war veterans? What if all their signs had said right wing and anti-war? Conservative, patriot, American and anti-war? And what if that had happened by the thousands and thousands in every city? Well, I guess Bush would have still launched the war anyway. But I think it would have definitely made a huge difference in the public perception of what was happening, because it was so easy for them. And, you know, the real commies, the Answer Coalition guys, they were literally inviting Jane Fonda to come and speak at their damn things. Like, are you trying to make the war last longer or what? God. That's the absolute worst, stupidest thing you could possibly do, man. Get clean for Jean, right? Wear a suit. Wear your camouflage left over from when you were in the service and get out there and say you're against the war for God and country and all that patriotic crap that they were pushing. Instead, they said, no, everybody who loves their country, everybody who ever was in the military, everybody who isn't a communist is for this. And the people who are against it, yeah, the same stinky hippies that are against everything, but who cares what they say? And I'm not saying that that was true at all. I'm only saying I know for a fact it wasn't true. I'm saying that was the media message that they were able to push and successfully. And so for issues like empire and then especially law and order, prison sentences and stuff like this, you need right-wing, Christian, business-owning white guys to come out and say this has all gone too far. I'm for law and order, and that's why I want to roll this back, because that's not what this is. Right? Get it? Attack the right from the right? We need that. Join up. Hey, Al Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver commodity discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. NatSummit.org. Sorry there, I went on too long about the war. I was trying to talk about the whole law and order thing. I got a great example for you. Judge Jim Gray from Southern California, from Orange County, who actually I really resent because he helped make the Libertarian Party horrible on the Iraq War right when it was most important that they be good on it, so damn him for that. But anyway, Judge Jim Gray, he's a right-wing conservative Republican judge from Orange County, which, if you ain't familiar, that's where the Republicans live in California. Well, they're in Pasadena. Anyway, what happened was, is he said, finally, that this drug war is just madness. I mean, what am I doing? My profession is locking people in a cage for doing drugs and trading in drugs. This is just stupid. It's got to stop. And I think, I forget now if he just started with weed or if it was, he realized, no, cocaine and everything too. This is just completely the wrong approach, you know, kind of deal. Anyway, he ended up joining the Libertarian Party, and he's a Libertarian Party kind of a libertarian, right? Pretty good on most stuff, but, you know, more of an activist than a reader, so not that good. But anyway, it's better that he's not, right? If he was a pure libertarian, he wouldn't serve his purpose nearly as well. The most important thing about Judge Jim Gray is that he can be invited to give a speech to groups of right-wingers, and he can introduce himself by saying, "Hi, I'm a conservative Republican judge from Orange County, where the Republicans live in California. And now let me tell you why I have to be against the drug war. I just can't support it when the facts are thus. And so join me in adopting a true conservative policy of rolling back this madness. This is the wrong public policy choice." And then conservatives can listen to that from him, right? They don't want to hear, "Hey, man, I want to get high, so leave me alone, dude." Because their attitude is, "You don't have rights. We'll tell you what to do. We're conservatives. We own you. We're collectivists like, you know, Vladimir Lenin. And we don't respect your right to do what you want. We're conservatives," they yell, they shout. It has to be a public policy recommendation from a guy like Judge Gray. In this case, this entire Texas public policy action is about rolling back, it's about attacking, not in a radical way, but attacking the police state and pushing to roll it back from all conservative points of view, right? So I don't know if they get into Jesus too much here, but they certainly focus on the costs. How much per prisoner, how much per year is being wasted on this, right? You gotta love conservatives, right? It's not about the right of any one of those men locked in those cages or women to live their life and be free and do what they want because you got no real right over them. They hadn't done anything to deserve being kidnapped and locked away, like violating someone else's rights in any serious way. That's not it, right? Because nobody's saying, "Hey, you know, shorten the sentences for rapists and armed robbers and murderers," right? Nobody's saying that. It's all the other stuff. It's all the victimless crimes that's driving the whole system mad, right? But anyway, so good. I'm glad that they're focusing on the costs, because you know what? The truth is, to a bunch of guys at the country club, they don't care. They never will care. about the individual natural human right, the self-evident right to life and liberty, possessed by people who they imagine are all poor and brown and beyond the freeway and beyond the pale. And if the government locks them up, well, they must have done something, collateral damage and yada, yada, yada. They don't care at all. They never will care about people locked up just because they're locked up. You know, as long as they're from the other neighborhood. And so you got to attack them from the spending. That's their conservative tax money being taken from them. They're the ones paying the taxes. So put it to them that way. I know that you love having the cops kidnap and cage black and brown people, mostly, all day on these bogus drug possession and trading charges, conservatives. But this is starting to cost you a lot. Are you sure you want to stick with this no matter what? I mean, the pleasure that you take in knowing that they have no rights, that they're locked in cages and being raped and beaten and stabbed and forced into racial gangs and God knows what. You know, I know you love it. I know you like watching MSNBC documentaries about it on the weekends and all. But man, it's expensive. Did you ever think of that? Or, in rare cases, I guess this is a right-wing argument, too, that Jesus is going to punish you for being so cruel, for supporting a conservative criminal justice policy, which guarantees innocent people go to prison for so-called crimes, offenses against state power. I mean, what about that, right? I mean, if you're a Christian, that's not supposed to be just a group identity thing, right? That's supposed to be the name of your personal relationship with the supernatural and all of that. Well, do you really believe? Or don't you? And, I mean, you look at just, and never even mind anybody else, man. I'm a Texas nationalist, if anything. Well, no, I mean, if I'm any kind of nationalist, I'm an individualist. But if I gotta be any kind of nationalist, Texas is my country. But so just think, right? The rest of you, you do your own damn experiment in your own brain. Just imagine how much money has been spent, how many lives have been ruined, how different our society in Texas is because of our, bogus war on crime and war on drugs, because of the unleashing of the police power here. Just think of the opportunity cost, you know? Just think of, it's the same kind of thing. I'm not even an armchair sociologist. Man, I'm the worst. But you don't have to be anybody with any kind of education at all to see the long-term effects of things like school-to-prison pipelines. So we're just entire segments of the population are, you know, stopping at jail for at least a while before they can pass go and carry on. And that's a part of who they are now. That's a part of why they can't get work now. That's a part of why their families are falling apart and are guaranteed to, or almost guaranteed to carry on the same kind of problems into the next generation. It's the same as, like, you know, when we talk about the boom and bust cycle on this show. The Federal Reserve creates an extra few $1 trillion with their police power, and they dump it into the economy where, you know, mostly their friends can get it first. So it goes into giant stock market bubbles and giant housing bubbles and giant dot-com bubbles of, investment firms and all this, getting all this free money. And then the entire economy suffers. And then we go through these recessions that last, you know, I don't know, eras, mini eras even, you know? Like the first half of the Bush years. That's sort of like a period of time, right? It's a segment of our history. Same thing for Obama years, going through these recessions. But so what does that mean, especially for people who are, living on the poor and browner side of town in the first place, when they have less opportunities in the first place? Their unemployment rate right now among young black and Hispanic people in every town, in every state, is, I don't know, however many points, usually like eyebrow raisingly much higher percentages than the population as a whole or than white unemployment. And so, but then, so what does that do when you have, never even mind the racial aspect, just what does that do when you have half the population, or, you know, most people live in paycheck to paycheck, but a lot of people can't even get a paycheck at all. Maybe a full third of them or something who are on some kind of, food stamps and welfareism and disability. They can't get job experience. They don't have access to better education. They got nothing to do but trade in drugs and go to prison. And, anyway, it's cannibalism is what it is, you know? It's, if you could somehow, you know, do like a Ghost of Christmas Past thing and just stop time and step back and look at the lost opportunities because of the war on drugs in this state over the last two generations, you know, what these lives could have been that ended in the violence. What these lives could have accomplished for themselves and for the people that they care about. Never mind, screw you and your economy and everything. Like, people exist to serve you. What about the people they want to serve? What about the people they didn't have the opportunity to serve? All the kids without fathers and all the broken homes and all the chaos. And all the long-term consequences for our future, too. It's just like invading Iraq. You didn't have to do that. But now look what you did. Full-scale Sunni-Shia Arab civil war to last how long? Jihadis, read Patrick Coburn, man. Jihadis spread now by the tens of thousands across the Middle East, where they did not exist before. You know? Where, and they're going to keep living for a while and acting, too. Man acts, that goes for jihadis also. Well, it's, you know what? It's a bad idea to have a government. It's a bad idea to have public policy at all. You see what your politicians, what troubles they get you into. You know, they claim to be your security force. The next thing you know, you're the one locked in a cage, wondering how the hell that happened. I pay your taxes. You can't do this to me. Really? Nowadays, you're lucky if you live to see your prison cell. The cops might just put a bullet in your head on the side of the road, as soon as they kick in your door for the fun of it with no accountability whatsoever. It's really a bad idea to have a national security policy, to have a national defense force, a standing army, or a CIA or any of this of any kind. All they do is get you in trouble. They don't keep the nation safe. They only create enemies for you and for everybody else. They only ruin everything. Anyway, yeah, don't you hate the government? Who doesn't hate the, you libertarians hate the government so much. You don't hate them so much? I don't understand. I really don't. Ah, just killed another kid for fun. Oh, well, I'll write that off. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you all. Welcome back. I'm Scott. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Rubbing my eyeballs, man. I'm tired. I'll just talk a bunch. That'll help wake me up. All right. Nathaniel Ferguson. Coming up on the show to attack the police state from the right. And I'm fairly certain he's not going to call it that. But that's all right. Yeah, here's a note of something I wanted to bring up, too. Now, you know what? Here's the thing about it. I'm a plumb line libertarian, and I can't stand people disagreeing with me, because if you disagree with me, then that means that you think that government should do something. And so I vehemently oppose that, you know, anything. However, I got to remind myself, I don't know if you have the same problem, if you're an anarchist libertarian like myself, I do have a problem with resenting people who disagree with me too damn much. Because the truth of the matter is, in this real world I live in, I want to be, you know, more free. Like the great bumper sticker says, yeah, I made it up. Demand total liberty. You might get to keep some. And so we definitely need, my position, I'm a William Lloyd Garrison type. My position is the furthest extreme of absolute and total opposition to all of it. And then I'm trying to do my best to show you that that's really the pragmatic thing to do. Honestly, it's not that radical. It's what's right. It's radical compared to the system that we live under. But anyway, the thing of it is, I recognize that even though there are growing and growing numbers of people who identify themselves as libertarians and who are reading Rothbard and getting better all the time, that there are a hell of a lot of people who aren't. There are a lot of people who are liberals and conservatives, and they're always going to be, or progressives, or whatever kind of right-wingers, or whatever you call yourselves, religious right-wingers and fiscal conservative types, and then all the different kinds of left-wingers that there are, and there are lots of different kinds of left-wingers. I wouldn't dare to try to label you guys, man. You can come up with your own sect. I don't mind. But the best I can do is try to help. And of course, I meant to not leave out all the independents and all the people who just don't really have a political ideology, but who are basically just regular American people trying to live their lives as best they can. And sometimes they vote against a guy if he really creeps them out, or they vote for a guy if they really kind of like what that guy says, but they pretty much just kind of take that sort of general point of view. I'm trying to lead all of y'all toward my abolitionist anarchist position. And so I got to try to be better about, you know, being so quick to condemn everybody else, because the truth of the matter is liberalism is, you know, about at least a fifth about liberty, kind of, you know. There are some libertarian parts of liberalism even still, although what a weird ideology. I don't know how you keep up with your own thinking there. But anyway, American conservatism, okay, sort of, kind of, it's partially true that in some cases, American conservatism is about preserving that old liberalism of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson, real liberalism, libertarianism, you know, natural rights theory, and then all of the logical propositions that go from there. That's what the American Revolution is based on. Now, not all of American society is based on the American Revolution. There's a hell of a lot of parts of American society ain't got a damn thing to do with it. But that's the legacy of the Revolution, is that Jeffersonian, Enlightenment, rationalist, deist, you know, if not outright atheistic, that rationalist part of the American mind, if you could call it that. That's the legacy of the founding of this country, that all men are created equal and have natural rights, self-evident natural rights. We don't have to prove it. We just believe in it, and we're armed, and we're willing to fight over it. So leave us alone. It's self-evident to us that everybody's born with natural rights. That's the legacy of the original part of America's, the American government's founding. And so, conservatives, no matter how conservative they are, they can't help but by default actually be liberals in that very, very littlest L old school classical liberal sense. What they're trying to conserve is the American system that presumably is, you know, created for the protection of liberty. Because liberty works best anyway, and it's great, and all of that. So, in other words, liberals and conservatives, at their cores, somewhere, are right about stuff. It's all your ideologies that got you way off course here, where you start coming up with excuses for controlling other people who actually don't belong to you. But anyway, so I think it's possible to prove the case, to state the case and win agreement. I don't know. Let Anthony prove it. I'm no good at that. Let Anthony Gregory write it up. I'm just saying, I think it should be possible for libertarians to state the case and to get liberals and conservatives to assent to the argument, to agree that what's most important is ending the wars and preserving our Bill of Rights. And that means even if they come up with a big news story that's supposed to really impress you about what's going on over there in the Crimean Peninsula or whatever the hell, that people can get their priorities straight, put their fiscal discipline first, or put their humanitarian principles first, or whichever it has to be to get them good on these most important priorities. And the fact is, even if you're a left-leaning liberal type and you want, say, for example, third-payer socialist health care, because you think, falsely, that's the only way to guarantee that people can get care and not have to just die only just because they're poor, you know? Come on. Even if you think that, you have to admit that the government helping people or getting the government to, quote, at least, help people is less important than making them stop hurting people, right? If most of what the government does all day is put firepower on targets, then you have to stop that. That has to be the most important thing. And especially when that's why you live in a totalitarian police state, that's why you're afraid of the cops, is because they're vets of these wars. You know how they are. You know what they're armed with. If you heard the show yesterday, you know how high-tech their complete and total surveillance grid can and will be in a very short amount of time. So, sorry. You know, get your priorities right. Ending the empire and rolling back the police state, that's got to come first. You know, and the same thing for conservatives. Man, conservatives, and I can pretend your point of view for a minute. I understand the whole freak out about abortion. I understand how it's a real big deal, the conservatives, about abortion. It's a religious thing, and then it's also argument about the power of a judge to say who's a human and who's not, and that's kind of objectionable, isn't it? And blah, blah, blah. And they got a million reasons they want to fight about abortions. Maybe really damned important ones. But they also know that they're never going to get any kind of compromise or agreement or change of mind with their opposition on it. Not that they could never win on the issue. They can win on the issue. But they certainly know that they're going to completely divide themselves from everyone else who's on the other side of that issue. You know, at least in any short term. And prevent any kind of alliance on more important issues. And so, for example, you're going to see Rand Paul try to appeal on the National Security Agency and other civil liberties issues like that and try to appeal to the left. And the liberal answer is going to be no. Vote for the totalitarian, communist, fascist dictator Hillary Clinton because Rand Paul is against abortion. Oh, abortion's got to come first. And that's the same for the liberals and the conservatives. I didn't mean to just pick on the conservatives. It's the same thing for both. And all the conservatives have come out, and, you know, they might be able to come to agreement on some important things, but no, they'll refuse to build the proper coalitions. And it's not just abortion, right? There are a few other issues. Even though the party's in power, there's not a dime worth of difference between them, really. Between their bases, there are the cultural differences, and on some of those other issues like that, medicine and things like that. People just always try to find a way to divide each other. But I think that if we look at the most important issues first, by the way, I rank them, then we ought to be able to get everybody to agree with that, right? Even the conservatives all wish they could take back the Bush years now. Everybody wishes that had never happened. And, well, when they're honest. And so, you know, anyway, I don't know, man. I'm just trying to say, I want a realignment. I want people to get their act together, and I want, you know, for people to recognize that the libertarian radicals, and we are radicals, but that we're the actual moderates, that it's the so-called moderates, the centrists, the liberal Republicans, and the conservative Democrats, they are the true extremists. They're the ones who, hey, first and foremost, are bankrupting the entire society, never mind bankrupting the government. They're bankrupting the entire society. How extreme is that? How moderate is that? And, you know, waging a world revolution all the time, you know, supporting dictators in Egypt and jihadi revolutionaries in Syria and whatever. They can't make up their mind what the hell they're doing there. But, you know, and waging the world empire, invading Africa, and pivoting to Asia and all this kind of crap. That's the extremism. The support that we've had thus far, the centrist bipartisan consensus for the war on drugs, for the federal war on drugs, and the international war on drugs that's killed tens of thousands, maybe more, of Mexicans just in the past 7-8 years, right? When was it that Calderon came to power? In like 06 or 07 or something? He called out the military at George Bush's insistence. We're gonna find, you know who can't be beaten? The army. We're gonna beat drug supply and demand from now on with our brute force. That's American policy. I'm sorry, I'm off on a tangent. I forgot how to get back to where I was. Oh yeah, it was about how the libertarians, we're the true moderates. We're the ones who just want to leave everybody alone. We're the ones who want a free society. We're the ones who want the society that they sell this government as representing, as, you know, as having the job of protecting for you, you know, a free one. And so I would like to think, and I do think it's possible for liberals and conservatives to get their act together, to realign against power, realign for the core of what you believe in. Real classical liberalism and the conservation of real classical liberalism. You right? Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and all right, I'm sorry, I'm done ranting and raving, man. I got a lot of news to cover for you. This Obama guy, the president, he gave his speech today over there in Europe. He's in Brussels for the G7. They kicked Russia out of it, so now it's the 7 instead of the 8 again. And I didn't get a chance to watch the whole thing. This guy's so tiring to me. This Barack Obama, you know, all these politicians, they elicit different emotions. Like when Sarah Palin starts talking, I put my fingers in my ears and I start screaming because I just can't stand it. Oh, God. Obama just puts me to sleep. Bush would drive me into a rage, but I didn't really hate his voice. You know what I mean? But Obama, I just... The way he talks, it's like he's hypnotizing me. I can't even listen to what he's saying anymore. It's like trying to reread the same article that I already wrote, and I'm trying to reread it and proofread it, but now I'm rereading it for the 1,000th time, and I can't even read it anymore. I'm just staring at it, and it's not working on me. It's like that. I just can't listen to him. It's the weirdest thing. Anyway, so I was trying to listen to the president earlier, and one of the things that, well, he was trying to basically Fisk Vladimir Putin's speech, which he's way too late, by the way. You know, if he was going to do that, he should have come out that night or the next day or something like that. He's trying to Fisk Putin's speech, and he makes the point that, you know, in Kosovo there was, you know, already a real problem going on where there was no problem in Crimea, so that's not an exact parallel, but that doesn't matter. And the truth is, you shouldn't bring that up, Obama, because the rest of us might start remembering how Bill Clinton said that 100,000 Kosovar Albanians had been killed, that it was a genocide, and that it absolutely had to be stopped, when in truth, that was not the truth. And when the war was over, and the FBI went there to investigate, they found 2,000-something bodies, and there was no evidence, and they were all fighting-age males, presumably combatants. There was nothing to even indicate that anywhere that women and children had been rounded up and shot, whatever. 100,000 civilians had been killed. And he wasn't claiming over a long period of warfare, collateral damage or anything. He was claiming that the Serbs were just going in there and murdering every civilian they could, like it was the Gestapo. Just going in 100,000 in the space of a couple of months or something. It was a lie. And then he goes, yeah, and we use the international system. No, Bill Clinton did not go to the United Nations. Not that this really makes a difference. It kind of does for his argument, but not in morality, not in a moral sense. Nice talking, Horton. Anyway, they went to just NATO did it. Because, of course, Russia has a veto on the UN Security Council. Now, the current state of world federalism law is that aggressive war is illegal. Invasion is illegal. Unless the UN Security Council votes for it. And if they have a resolution launching a war, then kill away. Now, that's completely ridiculous, isn't it? And yet, somehow, well, I guess it's people think it's better than the alternative, I guess, which is states just going to war all the damn time or whatever. I don't really agree with that, but the only way that it's enforced is by having states like the U.S. that are too big for anyone to enforce it on us. And so, anyway, the Kosovo war was a war crime. As simple as that. Bill Clinton belongs in life in prison right next to Dick Cheney for launching an aggressive war. And if you go back and look, it was just a victory lap for winning in the Senate. And it was, and then go back and look at Gail Sheehy's book, Hillary's Choice. And you can actually find this link at, what's that website where they do War and Peace on the Issues, your candidate on the issues. And it's a very, you know, straight-laced site. It's just quotes. Nobody's making a point. They're just saying, here are quotes of things that Newt Gingrich has said about issues of war and peace before. And then they have some quotes. Well, there's the quote of Hillary Clinton out of Gail Sheehy's book, I urged Bill to bomb. That's her quote directly. She pushed Bill Clinton into doing that war. And so Putin cited that, and then Obama's pretended refutation was a complete ridiculous failure. And then he brings up Iraq. And it's like, look, dude, you're a president. You can lie about whatever you want all the time. You do. And most assuredly, you can lie by omission. When it comes to Iraq, I think you're better off lying by omission. Because what he said about Iraq was, oh yeah, well, you know, and then Putin brings up Iraq and tries to say that, you know, America's hypocritical because of Iraq. Well, yeah, and do tell, Mr. President, what? And you're going to refute that with what? And this is where he says, but we went through the international system. No, you did not. They got a UN resolution back in the fall of 2002 saying we want a renewed inspection regime and you better open up. And then they tried to get a second UN resolution
But it was clear that France and Russia and China would not vote for it. So they never did submit the second resolution to a vote. They just went to war anyway. For Obama to pretend to claim otherwise is just insulting. I mean, come on, the whole world. This wasn't a speech that he gave at a high school. This is a speech he gave at The Hague. To a room, everybody in the room was some kind of pretend statesman or another. And none of them were buying it. None of them. And you could see, they kept, showing the audience. And they're like, okay, whatever. I sure as hell wasn't buying it. And he brought up Libya. He talks about Ukraine. He goes, hey, we didn't put all the people in the Maidan. Yeah, but so they weren't the ones who overthrew the government. You are. You and your Nazi friends and your threats of sanctions are what overthrew the government. So it doesn't matter whether you're the one who put all the people in the Maidan Square there. And, of course, it's a fact that, yeah, sort of, kind of, he did, because the NGOs of Ukraine have been bankrolling the hell out of the opposition this whole time for just this occasion. And that's no secret at all. In fact, there's a great new write-up about it over at the Ron Paul Institute website about how much money and support has gone through these NGOs to the opposition groups, the Tymoshenko supporters and Yanukovych opponents there in Ukraine. And then he goes, oh, so we didn't put him in the Maidan. Well, yeah, you did, and that isn't the whole argument anyway, so shut up. And then the second point is, and we're not the ones who caused the revolt in Libya, caused the people to come out and protest against Gaddafi. Yeah, and what about the rest of what happened? Yeah, he was the one who launched a war. He was the one who got a UN resolution authorizing a no-fly zone to protect Benghazi against total invasion, which was a made-up threat anyway. And then, just like I told you would happen, once the premise was set in a UN resolution that, well, hey, if we have to have a no-fly zone to protect the people of Libya, then it logically follows in one step. This is what they call calculus in Washington, D.C. And if you ever hear someone say that, punch them in the face really, really hard. Well, I don't know. Maybe don't do that, but tell them that they should be punched in the face really, really hard. Yes. This one simple step of logic, it's called calculus, to one of these political class blowhards. And the one step of logic was, hey, if the people of Benghazi aren't safe from Gaddafi without a no-fly zone, they'll never be safe from Gaddafi as long as he's in power. Wow, what a complicated mathematical equation, Scott Horton. I'm so impressed. I know, me too. Call it basic arithmetic. Math. Yes, we did the math. 3 + 1 = 4. Oh, good. And so then they waged a war. And it took them, 7 months to overthrow Gaddafi, to finally bomb him out of power with their special forces and their NATO Air Force. American taxpayers paying for the entire thing, even when for the period of time where the Europeans were leading it. It was our bombs and our money fueling their planes and everything else, coordinating the whole damn war. And then Obama goes, yeah, so, you know, we're just trying to help, and that's nothing like this. Anyway, I told you before, I don't think that there should be a government in Crimea at all. I think it's arguable whether Crimea is or isn't part of Russia, or could or couldn't be, or should or shouldn't be. And, you know, I laugh at the Americans when they hold elections while they're occupying a country, like in Iraq and Afghanistan, bogus elections that nobody can really respect. But it sure does look to me like you had mass support in Crimea for that vote. If that was just a fake, you know, color-coded revolution of the Russians in Crimea, you sure fooled me. I don't think so. You don't have to take the side of the Russians. And really, that's all besides the point anyway. The only real point that's worth making for an American libertarian on a question of foreign policy like this is, well, there are two. First is, I don't care what happens, none of your damn business, back off, U.S. government. Stay out of it. But then, more to the point, America caused this. America bankrolled the revolution. America did a coup d'etat and overthrew a democratically elected government. And so what the Russians did in response doesn't matter whether it's justifiable or not, isn't the question. The question is could that be expected or not? Is that not the obvious natural thing for them to do or not? And the answer is obviously yes, to protect their base from being part of NATO. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our guest today is Nathaniel Ferguson. He is from Texas Public Policy Action and Right on Crime, TexasAction.com. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Nathaniel?
I'm doing great. Appreciate you having me on the program today, Scott.
Yeah, sure thing. I'm very happy to have you on here. First of all, any friend of John Utley's is a friend of mine. And second of all, I love the entire idea, generally speaking anyway, about a right-wing conservative push for criminal justice reform, justice on foreign policy issues, et cetera, et cetera. It's always best to attack the right from the right. Nobody really cares what some hippie grad student says about criminal justice. What we need is people who are former cops, former military guys, who are conservatives, who are businessmen, to say this has got to stop. Where this is the wrong policy. We could be law and order as hell and against what's going on now, because this ain't law and order. This is screwing us up. This is undermining what our society is supposed to be, and we've got to knock it off. And so thank you, first of all, just for being part of this. And I put a lot of faith I don't know about that, but I sure hope that you guys can really make a difference by taking this tack.
Well, I appreciate that, and that's a great endorsement of the criminal justice reform initiative. And I want to clarify one thing real quickly, that as executive director of Texas Public Policy Action, I'm not actually officially affiliated with Right on Crime. I'm just a person. My organization, we believe in what the guys at Right on Crime are doing, and we support it, and we're out championing what they're doing. But I myself am not one of the eggheads that's over there at Right on Crime proving this stuff and proving that these reforms are effective.
Gotcha.
And that they have, this isn't some sort of fanciful, wishful thinking kind of solutions. These are actually data-driven, experience-based, we know that they work kind of things, and they're doing a fantastic job over there.
All right, well, so give us a good idea of where you're going with this.
Okay, all right. Well, just a little bit of overview first before we talk about what some of the solutions are. I think probably your audience is pretty well-versed in a lot of this already, but we'll hit it just for kicks, right? I think broadly we can agree that there are too many laws and too many regulations, and that those things are leading to too many people in prison for too long a period of time, at too great a cost, often at a length of time that is vastly disproportionate to whatever crime they may have committed. And that as a result, we're seeing prisons and the criminal justice system focus less on criminal justice, less on victim restitution, and more on just another big government, costly, unwieldy, very not conservative, not American in the traditional sense, kind of enterprise. And so what the guys at the Right on Crime Initiative are trying to do, and by the way, this is a Texas-based national initiative. So this thing is being tried in a growing number of states across the nation. It's being looked at by the United States government. The U.S. Senate is holding hearings on things like mandatory minimums, Solitary confinement is a major issue where people are just being put in solitary confinement for, you know, indefinite periods of time and then being released directly to the public with no transition period in between. So they're, yeah, I don't know about you, but if I was in solitary confinement for a long time, I don't know that I would necessarily be in a place where I'd be ready to be released to the public, you know? So these are problems, and they're part of the problem of having this big government solution to criminal justice, which we've had for at least a generation in this country. So that's sort of the background, the backstory of it. And Texas is really leading the nation on this. And we're talking about reforms that have been implemented in Texas that, you know, what we've seen is a couple of years ago, they were talking about building a couple of new prisons in Texas. And said, we're going to, you know, legislators, we're going to have to go back to their constituents and sell them on the idea of spending $2.1 billion to build 17,000 new prison beds in Texas. And so what they did is they started doing these different reforms, looking at things like you know, drug courts and looking at first-time nonviolent offenders and saying, hey, how about we don't make prison be the first option for these people? How about we look at some other options as first solutions, first interventions, lower-level interventions that cost less money, lead to lower recidivism rates, and these kind of things. And so through these reforms, you have a situation where in Texas, they're not building prisons, they're closing them. In Texas, we are at something like 94% of capacity in our prisons. That's after we've closed prisons down.
Really?
In California, by contrast, yeah, absolutely. And by the way...
Well, wait a minute. So I'm sorry. I must have missed the part where you explain really... what kind of sentences are being reduced for how many people or something? Did you say that? How do you explain they're actually closing prisons from the 2007 reforms?
Right. So what they're able to do is,
I mean, give us some examples. Like they got rid of mandatory minimums for cocaine or something. I don't know. I'm just making that up. But tell us how this happened. What are you talking about? How did they do it?
Well, there's a number of different reforms. One of the main things is by shifting money away from building prisons and increasing prison infrastructure towards things like implementing drug courts where people who are low-level, nonviolent offenders, instead of just throwing them in prison and locking away the key, they're going and doing things like adult probation where it's something that's more proportional to the crime. You know, it costs, in Texas, it costs about $16,000 a year on average to house an inmate.
Mm-hmm.
It costs about $2,500 to $4,000 a year to do things like put an ankle monitor on them, have them on probation, have them in some kind of work relief program. So there are obviously numerous benefits. The first benefit is to the taxpayer, who's not having to pay these exorbitant costs to build and facilitate and manage new prisons. There's the cost to the individual offender themselves, who has an option other than going to prison and is able to, in a sense, maybe have a wake-up call and pay some sort of a penalty for whatever crime that it was, but still be able to be a functioning member of society. The economy benefits because these people, instead of being pulled out of the economy, are still able to work and have jobs and produce. The families benefit because you're not taking people away from their families. Mm-hmm. They're able to raise their own kids, you know, and do their best to be good husbands, good fathers, good wives, and good mothers, et cetera, and be able to actually raise their own kids. So you're having fewer kids who are having to go into the, you know, foster care system or these other types mm-hmm. of things. The economic ramifications, it's a ripple effect, and it touches a lot of things that go far beyond just those first layer level of things that you would consider.
Right. Well, and it just goes to show just how harmful these kind of sentences have been on those exact issues, destroying people's families and that kind of thing.
That's right.
And now,
well, and so for years, you've had this mentality of lock them up and throw away the key, right? And I think on the right, on our side, we're new to this issue in many respects. People thought that it was people were shocked at how much attention this got at CPAC and how popular the Right on Crime booth was. And the fact that there was a panel discussion on the main stage that was very well attended and very well received with Grover Norquist, Pat Nolan, and Rick Perry out there championing this issue. And the Washington Post the next day did a big write-up about how, you know, people on the right are wanting to make criminal justice reform a central issue going forward.
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess I would expect something like this from Norquist, because he's more of a fiscal conservative than a hard ideologue, right, as far as, you know, what ought to be illegal, right? He's just mostly focused on repealing taxes all the time and heroic stuff like that. So I could see this fitting in with him pretty well. I think, well, now, and so what about, and look, I understand you got to take a very utilitarian tack. You've got to be able to answer every question why this will be better, pragmatically speaking. But what about the morality of locking people up simply for consuming or trading in drugs? I mean, what about, you know, really even the premise that the people of the state of Texas really have the right to have the government of the state of Texas pass these kind of laws in the first place that would take a man from his family simply for selling drugs to somebody who wanted to buy them? Isn't that madness? I mean, we got rid of prohibition 70 years ago because it was madness.
Yeah, you know what? So this is it's interesting because this is an issue that is very unique, especially in this day and age when there's it's very difficult to get broad consensus or broad agreement on anything, much less something that's major. So now here we have a major issue, criminal justice reform, where you have the left, the center, the right, liberals, you know, conservatives, Republicans.
We need a consensus. I understand what you're saying. You can't get into everything. You can't be perfect on everything if you want to actually get things done. I certainly understand.
So right. Everyone,
I'm sorry, Nathaniel, I got to stop you here just because we got to take this stupid break. You know, we got to pay the bills. It's not that stupid of a break. But then we'll be right back and finish up here. We're talking with Nathaniel Ferguson from Texas Public Policy Action. They're attacking the criminal justice system from the right, trying to roll it back and set things straight a little bit here. TexasAction.com. Back after this. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for TheBumperSticker.com. I created it, but quickly sold it to Rick so I could do this instead. In the decades since, he's made one hell of a great company. TheBumperSticker.com makes digitally printed, photo-quality, full-color bumper stickers for your band or your business, as well as magnets, adhesive vinyl decals, and labels for products and industrial use, and your political cause or campaign, too. TheBumperSticker.com also offers full custom graphic design for bringing your idea to reality. Let TheBumperSticker.com help you get the word out. That's TheBumperSticker.com at TheBumperSticker.com. And tell them you heard it here. All right, we're back now, and, you know, I was going to kind of just abandon my point there because it is just, you know, it's my libertarian hobby horse that I want everything perfect, and I refuse to accept just half a loaf and that kind of thing. But then on the other hand, I thought, nah, you know, I think we do need to stay with this question of whether it's even really right to have any of these drug laws at all when it comes to just trading in them or possessing them, because this goes along with what you were saying at the beginning about just too many people being convicted. There are just too many things that are illegal. And I think, I don't remember your exact words, but what you're getting at there is you're talking about all the offenses that have been dreamt up by the rulers of our society that can get people in trouble. All the things that aren't crimes, right? But all the things that'll get you in trouble with, you know, like somebody picks up a, where did I read? Somebody picked up a rusty can from the woods and brought it home, and they went to federal prison for it because, you know, Lord knows, there's some EPA regulation says you can't. That kind of thing. That's what Bernie Kerik was saying. The former commissioner of the police in New York just got out of the pen where he belonged for his mobster corruption. But he got out and said, hey, guys, listen to me. There are good people in there, man. This is not what you think. You know, something's gone wrong. We've gone way, way too far here. And it seems like it's the war on drugs, man. Come on, that's what it is. There are all kind of people who are not criminals, who never would shoot anybody, who never violated anybody's rights, who never really committed a crime, but who are guilty of these offenses against the state's edicts. And that's what's got to change here, or we're not changing anything, right?
Yeah, no, but you're absolutely right about that. And there are things, I think that Bernie Kerik talked about meeting a guy in prison who went to federal prison for a lengthy term. I don't remember how many years he said. It was a long time because he found a whale's tooth on the beach and he sold it on eBay, and the feds cracked down and said, well, you can't do that. And so they sent him to federal prison. And most likely the guy never even knew that it was against the law. You know, it used to be, well, lack of knowledge of the law isn't the defense. But that was back when we didn't have that many laws. And now we've got stacks and stacks of books, you know, that go miles high if you stack them all on top of each other, of all the laws and executive regulations like you're talking about with the EPA. And so you've got John Stossel did this crazy profile a couple of years ago of a guy who spent years in federal prison because he was selling seafood, it wasn't illegal to sell the type of seafood he was selling it, but he was selling it in a type of packaging that the federal government didn't like. And I don't remember what branch of government it was. When they prosecuted him, they weren't even prosecuting him based on U.S. law. They were prosecuting him based on some law from Honduras or El Salvador or some other country where the seafood originates from. So the guy would import it, package it in plastic instead of cardboard, and he went to federal prison for that. So, you know, in Texas, there are something like 12 felonies you can commit with an oyster. So, you harvest an oyster out of season or without the proper license or whatever, all of a sudden you're a felon. A felon. That's amazing. You know what happens when you're a felon? You lose rights. You lose economic opportunity. You lose social standing. A lot of times you lose your family. And then you lose your freedom because you reoffend because you couldn't get a job because no one would hire a felon when you shouldn't have been a felon in the first place. So the ramifications and the economic impacts of this are devastating. Now, you know, you're talking about things like full-scale legalization, you know, those kind of things. But from a policy perspective, I mean, that kind of thing just doesn't happen overnight, right? There's a lot of other steps that are
in between. You know, we see now that it's sort of just breaking through the legalization of pot all across the country, because everybody's known all along how stupid this is. And so now all of a sudden it's all kind of falling apart at once, right? Like William F. Buckley in the National Review came out against the drug war really in total, but especially the war against weed 25 years ago or something. So finally, as soon as it's apparently possible to actually legalize it, you got people all over the country. I think Alabama last week unanimously, both houses of their legislature unanimously passed legalizing medical pot in the reddest state of all, right? And so it's important anyway, even if I agree with you. I can't always have the whole loaf all at once of exactly what I want. But I think if we can forge a consensus that actually, you know, criminalizing cocaine doesn't seem to have any benefit, but it does seem to help spread the meth epidemic across the South. So, you know, maybe we should just legalize it. And maybe, you know, a few more people die of heart attacks, but probably not. And who cares anyway? It's their right anyway. And then, so in 10 years, people will say, of course, that makes sense. Let's go ahead and, you know, we got to, you know, be right at least, even if we can't get what we want yet.
Yeah, there's a sense of incrementalism to all these policy changes, right? But one of the things that is so just astounding to me is that you have this coalition of the left and the right and the center and, you know, libertarians, Republicans, Democrats all saying for different reasons, right? Conservatives are talking about the economic argument. Libertarians, by and large, are talking about their moral view of the criminalization of drugs. And for the left, by and large, it's sort of a social justice issue. So all the groups are framing it in different ways, using different words, and using the conservative argument is much newer than the libertarian or the
right.
or the liberal argument.
Right.
But now you have this alliance that's been forged where people who are not always in sync on these issues and may not even be in sync to the T on this issue, but in large part, 90% of it are in sync, and they're actually able to move something forward and get major things done. Right. And so, and this is happening, by the way that it should. This is happening at the state level. And the states are going, and they're seeing Texas has success, and they're saying, well, God, if Texas can do it, then I can do it. You know. And so you have Louisiana pushing major criminal justice reform, and all these other states are starting to do it. And then the federal government looks at it and says, well, man, well, I guess if all these states can do it, we can do it. And so you have Eric Holder, who is certainly no hero to the taxpayer or the American people, and he's out there getting on board with a bunch of this stuff, the Attorney General of the United States. And you have signatories, people who have signed on and said, put my name and, you know, in my endorsement on this, include Ed Meese, former Attorney General, numerous former Assistant Attorneys General of the United States, numerous former State Attorneys General. Just an amazing amount of firepower who are behind this issue, and I think that's why we're starting to see it really move forward and take root.
Mm-hmm. All right, now let me ask you about the militarization of the police. And this, of course, is mostly about the war on drugs, but then with the creation of the Department of Homeland Security and the advent of the war on terrorism, the Pentagon basically just said, you guys can come and have whatever you want almost for free. basically. And we've got cops running around with M16s all over the place, and armored personnel carriers and stuff. And I saw one congressman, and it was like seeing the sun for the first time in a year or something when I read a congressman in USA Today say he wanted to pass a bill rolling that back on the national level and making it harder for the Pentagon to give their equipment away. I was like, you got to be kidding me. Hallelujah. That's beautiful. What kind of consensus can we build on that? Because honestly, I don't think I'm a wimp to admit that I'm scared of these guys, man. These SWAT teams, they over nothing, they will kick in somebody's door with their MP5 German machine guns and stick them in your wife's face and God knows what. And they're terrorists. I mean, we got to roll that back. We have to, over war on drugs or whatever it is, these SWAT teams, right?
Well, I think this is an issue that is related but somewhat outside of the current criminal justice reform. It's more of a law enforcement reform issue, but I think you're right that it's gaining steam. I think it's gaining more attention. This issue of, you know, no-knock warrants, why can't you just serve why do you have to go bust in somebody's door while their wife and kids are sleeping and shoot their dog to serve them with arrest warrant? Why not just get them when they're, driving to the grocery store, something like that? There's a lot of ways that you can have common sense law enforcement. Part of it is this, it's almost an arms race with prosecutors, right? Because it's this idea of being tough on crime that says, well, okay, I'm going to run for higher office, and so I have to have an image that says I'm tough on crime. So I need to build up statistics of how many people I've put in prison and how many, people's lives I've saved by locking up all these people for lengthy terms, et cetera. And so, but it builds on itself and it feeds on itself, because the next person who's running has to be able to prove that they're tougher on crime than the last tough on crime guy. And so I think that's part of how we've gotten ourselves in this situation. And so now people, policymakers have to find ways to de-escalate that. And how do you do that? Because it takes political courage, because nobody wants to be the lone politician who's out there. I worked in Congress for a while. I know how these guys think. Nobody wants to go out there on a limb and be the guy who is standing there going, hey, we need to be softer on crime, because that's the way that it sounds, right?
Right.
And they're going to lose their election. They're going to be easily attacked. So it's a process of making the intellectual argument, backing it up with data, and going out there and having the argument be made outside of the political arena first in order to allow the politicians to have the cover they need to get on board with it. And it's pretty sick that that's the way that has to be done, but in the real world of politics and policymaking, that's pretty much how it has to happen. So you have, think tanks and outside special interest organizations that are out there, the Innocence Project going out there and doing fantastic work, getting people who are wrongly imprisoned off of death row, those kind of things. It's heartbreaking to see people spending decades of their lives in prison for crimes they didn't commit. Right here in Williamson County, Michael Morton, most of your listeners, I'm sure, probably familiar with that. I assume you've talked about it before. Decades of his life, almost 25 years in prison for a crime that he didn't commit, in which the DA and the sheriff most likely, at the time they prosecuted him, knew he didn't commit.
Yeah. All right, now, I'm sorry, we have very little time left for you to tell people how they can join, how they can help. What's the website? Texas Action. I'll say that part for you, texasaction.com.
So texasaction.com is my organization. Right on Crime has a separate website, rightoncrime.com. You can follow them at Right on Crime on Twitter. You can follow us at PPP Action, and we'll just work together.
Great.
Right.
Well, thanks so much. Again, I think it's so important that, you even especially emphasize the conservative nature of your approach here. I think it can make a real difference. Thank you very much, Nathaniel.
Thanks, Scott.
Nathaniel Ferguson, everybody, at TexasAction.com. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. Nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I like that guy. I talked too much during his damn interview. I'm sorry about that. But, you know, I gotta try, man, with the drug thing. And I'll have you know, and this is the truth, and I ain't really bragging or whatever, but, you know, it's kind of important. And maybe it's because in the back of my mind, I'm afraid that some cop is listening and is going to get me wrong. I've never done cocaine before in my entire life. How do you like that? And I've had friends who did a hell of a lot of coke, and nearby me. Well, I've never done any. Not never. Never smoked any in a joint or nothing. So, how do you like that? I am for the right of cocaine users to use cocaine. It's their right. More importantly, you have no authority to stop them. No legitimate authority to stop them. I carve out an exception for brothers and sisters, I guess. If an older brother or sister wants to beat up and tie up their younger brother or sister, I guess if the roles are reversed, that's okay too. And, you know, kidnap them and keep them at their house and feed them, but force them to kick whatever horrible addiction they have an addiction to, then you know what, man? That's kind of you guys. Normally I'm for the non-aggression principle, but older brother wants to beat up and kidnap his younger brother and make him kick? Eh, I don't know. I'm not sure I see the crime in that, really. But older brother does that to anyone else in the neighborhood, he's a criminal. Get it? You can't kidnap people and make them do what you want just because you want them to. Why isn't that obvious to people? I don't get it, really. Anyway, I am for the right of people to use cocaine. I'm for the right of people to abuse cocaine. I'd recommend against it. I've seen people actually get to the rock bottom of cocaine addiction, which is pretty bad, dude. I mean, I guess it could be worse. If you have to get addicted to a hard drug, coke is probably better for you than heroin, right? You know, all things being equal. It's got to be better for you than methamphetamine. And that's where the entire methamphetamine epidemic comes from. Oh my God, methamphetamine is tearing the country apart, reports political magazine in favor of more policing. Well, why is everybody doing meth? It's because they can't buy coke. And so they're making their own pseudo coke in the backyard. Out of beer cans and shit. I've seen it. Seen people throwing beer cans in a barrel full of meth brew. I mean, I guess, right, yeah, there's aluminum in it. I saw that on the Breaking Bad there. Why do people use meth? I mean, some people just prefer it to coke, but mostly it's because they can't afford coke. They can't find any coke because it's illegal. So they do meth, which is that much worse. Same thing for crack. Why do people do crack? Because it's cheap. I mean, I guess it's a totally different and more intense high and whatever than just regular doing cocaine, but who came up with it? People who were economizing, that's who. Just like during the Great Depression, people quit drinking beer and started drinking harder liquor instead. Because it's more drunk for the buck. Prices were raised artificially due to the scarcity imposed by the government in their stupid prohibition. And so people said, man, if I got to spend $30 out drinking, I'm drinking something hard liquor and get me drunk. instead of having a few beers and getting nowhere. I don't know what price. You understand, the new higher price. Same thing. That's why there's a meth epidemic. That's why there's a crack epidemic. It's because of your war on cocaine. And of course, what is the war on cocaine? It's the campaign of prosecution of people who possess and or trade in it. That's what it is. It ain't a war. It's all that crap I just said. Prosecutions of people. And so what does that do? It just drives up the price. It doesn't... Cocaine doesn't go, oh, you got me, and fall down dead on the field. They just keep making more of it. There's no surrender on the battleship. There is no war. It's just an endless game of attempting to limit the supply, from some cartels. Sinaloa, go ahead and sell whatever drugs you want. You work for us. But the rest of you. Boy, that Obama, he's like Ronald Reagan in more ways than a few, isn't he? All right. That's it. I'm not a cocaine user. I sure as hell don't possess any. Never have. Never used it in my whole life. So I don't want no SWAT raid over this, pigs, just because I'm for legalizing drugs. But, you know, that's a real problem for cops because they don't want to have to get jobs, you know, where they work for a living and work for people who pay them out of money that they got voluntarily for someone else. You see how that gives a boss a lot less incentive to pay money out if he had to work for it. He's only going to hire you if he likes you and if you're good at stuff. But if you're a cop, then you're obviously good for nothing, and that's why you're a cop. And so how in the hell are you going to work on the market out there? It's a tough life. If you have to get a real job, which I should talk, I get to do this for a living. But I've had lots of jobs before, jerks, and none of them working for the state ever. Although, I was a land surveyor on a government contract before, surveying for Highway 130, actually. And boy, did we goof off and do nothing when it was government contract time compared to when we had a private contract to survey stuff. And those were orders from the top, man. That wasn't me. I was the low man on the totem pole. I was the guy with the pole. I wasn't the one choosing to slack off. That was the orders from the boss. Y'all don't work too hard out there. Okay, we won't. Yeah, good old government. Anyway. Yeah, I don't know why people don't understand this about drugs, you know? I mean, this guy didn't have to convince him or whatever. I didn't want to argue with him anymore. But I actually considered, I wasn't sure who I was dealing with. I thought if he was going to be a bit right-wing and argue about, no, we don't want to legalize drugs because drugs are bad, okay? I was going to argue with him about, what if the Democrats outlawed guns? Would that get rid of guns? Or would only get rid of open market dealers in guns? And it would drive the gun market underground. And then the consequences of that would be that the most ruthless criminals would be the kings of that underground gun market, right? Uh-huh. And then a lot of innocent people would die, right? And would they ever actually get rid of guns? No. Only the criminals and the government would have many more compared to regular people, because a lot of regular people probably would turn in their guns. If that's the law, what are you going to do about it? But would you ever actually get guns, especially out of the hands of criminals, which would be the excuse for banning guns in the first place? Of course not. You're just going to start a war over it. A war on guns. Now, explain that to any conservative. Any conservative, and watch their head nod up and down. You're damn right. Doesn't make any sense at all to get rid of guns. Even if, in paradise, there are no guns and no man ever kill each other ever again. We don't live in paradise, we live on earth, and people do kill each other, and they attempt to kill each other, and people got a right to defend themselves from people using that level of aggressive violence against them. It's as simple as that, first of all. And second of all, an attempt to prohibit guns in this society would not, could not, achieve its stated goals. Well, drugs are the exact same thing. The exact same thing. You don't get rid of drugs. You just drive open market drug dealers out of business. Say, for example, the local drug store, which is where you used to be able to buy your heroin. Was at the drug store, your cocaine. You could get at the drug store. With or without a prescription? Probably without a prescription. That's how it used to be. They outlawed that. They drove trade in those substances into the underground black market, and then did that get rid of drug use? Did that get rid of the drug supply? No, of course not. All it did was put the drug business in the hands of the most ruthless, violent criminals to control their turf, to who use, of course, basically low-level aggressive war in order to settle their disputes. Because our wonderful, peaceful court system isn't open to them to sue each other over broken contracts and that kind of thing. So just like in the movies, you have that thing where people doing a big deal, even with somebody they've dealt with before. Man, if these guys decide this is the last time they're doing business with you, they might just kill you, take the money, and keep the drugs. Kind of thing, right? You got to deal with that every time you make a trade. Who made it that way? The government made it that way. You know, I think there's even an episode of The Sopranos where they're like, no, dude, if you legalize gambling, we'll kill you. Or what is it? Or is it Godfather 2 or something where they're trying to get gambling outlawed or some kind of crap? They're protecting their territory. We need that black market. We make a lot of money providing security for those games, man. Don't legalize gambling. I guess they figured out they could own the casinos and make more that way. But anyway, you understand. It's bootleggers and Baptists. Same thing during the prohibition of alcohol. Bootleggers and Baptists. The Baptists, oh, they know better than you, man. They're going to save your soul by taking your drink away. I mean, by artificially raising the price of your drink and making you a so-called criminal for participating in any alcoholic activities, etc. Oh, but they're going to save your soul. Oh, and the bootleggers, yeah, they were for prohibition too. In fact, just think right now, if they outlawed alcohol, just think how many more people could put their alcohol out there on the market. I know that sounds kind of counterintuitive, but you got to remember, you live in a fascist society here in the U.S. of A., where the alcohol industry is entirely controlled by state government cartels in almost every state. That's why people still drink Budweiser, is because there's no competition in beer. Yes, it's true. It's not absolutely impossible to get other kinds of beers if you go to a specialty store or whatever. But compared to if there was an open free market in alcohol, look, everyone who drinks beer loves beer, right? There would be an unlimited number of beers to choose from on the market if there was an open market in beer. In fact, if there was a black market in beer, it would probably open up to that many more. That's how fascistly controlled the cartel system in alcohol is right now. As crazy as that sounds. But if there was an open market, it would be entirely different. But anyway. Underground homebrewers, dude. Gotta crack down on them. No-knock SWAT raids. 20-year mandatory minimums. Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Did you guys see this new Glenn Greenwald this morning? This is really funny, dude. Here. Let me find it for you. Where the hell is my cursor, man? Come here. Come here, you dumb cursor. I'm talking at you.
Yeah, Glenn Greenwald. I love this guy. And you know what? I'm a little butthurt that he won't ever answer my emails no more and come on my radio show. I thought he said he wanted to there for a minute, but then I never heard from him again after that. But I don't care, man. I still love this guy, man. This, I'm still laughing my ass off of this. Obama's new NSA proposal and Democratic partisan hackery. Haha. So anyway, here's his point. You heard yesterday, we talked with Trevor Tim about it. Obama supposedly, and according to Charlie Savage, who's a good reporter at the New York Times, he does good work there. He used to be at the Boston Globe, and he does the Civil Liberties beat and that kind of thing, and he's a good guy. A credible journalist. And, well, probably a good guy too. I don't know. He's all right. And he says that Obama's got a proposal for reform for the NSA. And it's not as good as the Sensenbrenner proposal, apparently, but it sure as hell is better than the Mike Rogers one introduced in the House. And what it says is that basically the original story, the metadata, the phone metadata collection, that'll have to end. That the telecoms will keep their records just as long as they always have, and there will be no mandate for them to keep their records any longer than they always have, which Greenwald says is 18 months, but I thought that there are different times, different time periods that the telecoms had as their own standard. But I don't know my source for that. I defer to him on that, I guess. That they would then keep their stuff for 18 months and get rid of it, and there would be no mandate for them to keep it any longer than that. And the NSA would have to go to the FISA judge under exactly whatever standard, I'm not exactly positive, but they would have to go to the judge before they go to the telecoms to get permission to look at this stuff. So, in other words, according to what was explained to Charlie Savage, how it would be, this is fundamentally the end of the metadata, the phone metadata collection. Now, that's hardly the end all of everything. And Greenwald says that here, too. And believe me, I'm not even at the funny part yet. I'm not at the point yet. I'm just trying to catch you up from this proposal by Barack Obama. Basically, the president's proposal, as explained by Charlie Savage, is an end to the metadata collection. And so, but here's what's hilarious about this article. So Obama, so Greenwald starts out by saying, I recall the first time I realized how mindlessly and uncritically supportive of President Obama many Democrats were willing to be. It was in the beginning of 2009 when a judge said, you have to release all the torture photos. You know, the ones of American soldiers raping little kids and all that kind of stuff at Abu Ghraib. And Obama said he would do it. And then all the right-wingers attacked him. Liz Cheney and Bill Kristol and all them attacked him. Remember, this is early 09. He'd just been in power for a couple of months, 2 or 3 months. And then Obama changed his mind. Oh, wait. Before he changed his mind, everybody was defending Obama. All the liberal Democrats were defending Obama from Liz Cheney, the daughter of the chief torturer, the daughter of the guy most guilty of torture in the entire Bush administration. Who's attacking Obama. Like, boy, I can't think of a single talking point to defeat her on this question with, huh? Calling him a traitor for planning to do it. They all defended Obama from her and Bill Kristol and others, and then Obama reversed himself and said, you know what, I'm not going to release the photos because it could radicalize people against us and whatever. And so, yeah, he conceded, and he conceded on Bill Kristol's argument. And then all these Democrats turned around and defended him because, of course, Greenwald attacked him, and other liberals with principle, like he says, the ACLU here and others, they turned around and attacked him for it and said, hey, what the hell? You were right 2 weeks ago. Now you're flip-flopping. And then they got attacked, and all the pro-Obama Democrats all rose up to condemn his left-wing critics for daring to criticize dear leader. And, of course, their argument, they adopted the Obama-Cheney-Kristol argument. That if you tell the truth about what the prior government did and showed the American people what crimes they were guilty of, especially by then, everyone understood it wasn't just bad apples. Everyone understood by then that it was ordered from the top.
And so if you release those torture photos in, why, that could mean that the people start demanding prosecutions of the Republicans from the previous administration for what they had done. You know, which are, after all, felonies. You know, torturing somebody to death, that's against the law. Unless you're a Republican, I guess. But so, they all, they adopted the right-wing argument in order to defend Obama. And Greenwald is saying he couldn't believe it. It was just so amazing to watch them pivot on a dime like that. And he said, he asked then, which of you who are defending Obama on this criticized him 2 weeks ago when he had the opposite position and was preparing to leak the pictures? Somebody show me a liberal who was condemning Obama for preparing to leak the torture pictures who's now supporting him for changing his mind on it. Can't find one. Pathetic, disgusting. And eminently predictable. Give me a break, you know? Who couldn't have predicted that? I guess Greenwald learned a real lesson, he says. But now he says, hey, look, everybody. Barack Obama has a proposal, according to Charlie Savage, who's a decent reporter at the New York Times, to end the bulk metadata collection. So I guess that means that all the liberal Democrats who've been defending Obama this whole time and who've been attacking Snowden and been attacking him and defending the NSA program on the basis that Obama defended it on, that it was protecting us from terrorist attack, you irresponsible traitors and pseudo-opinionated journalists and all of their arguments. Now you all have to condemn Barack Obama, don't you? Aren't you all going to come out and condemn Obama now that he wants to stop the metadata program that you say is so vital to protecting us from the terrorists? And of course the answer is no. To love Obama is to love Obama. And to not be able to remember the day before yesterday is to be able to participate in American politics, basically. At least if you want a hero, if you want to believe in someone, if you want to side with a political personality, forgetting what you used to say the day before yesterday is pretty much top priority there. I think that's great. I love Glenn Greenwald. I'm sorry it took me so damn long to sum that up for you. Probably didn't even have much of a punchline by the time I got to the punchline. But isn't that great? Here, for 9 months straight, unlimited numbers of pseudo-liberal types who clearly are just tribally loyal to Obama as Democrats. They've been defending the NSA in order to attack Greenwald and to attack Snowden and to defend Obama. But now that Obama switched sides again, supposedly, what are they going to do? I mean, man, I guess I used to believe in Barack Obama and I used to defend him, but if he's going to abolish this metadata collection program and put us all at such risk, I just don't know if I can support him anymore. How many blog entries like that do you think are going to be written here? None. All right, and I'm sorry I haven't been able to finish up the interviews of Gareth Porter for you guys. He's on the road. I wish I realized that he was going and doing his speaking tour thing. I would have gone ahead and recorded these interviews off hours and wrapped this thing up by now. Now I got this, you know, two-day break in them. But anyway, eventually it's going to be, I guess, 9 parts. And I've gotten some positive feedback. Nobody's really criticized it yet. It's probably unprecedented in the history of radio for somebody to interview somebody day after day after day after day about chapter after chapter after chapter of their new book about Iran's nuclear program or anything else. But each chapter pretty much does stand alone, I think, and is worth an interview by itself. And then it all comes together like Voltron in the manufactured crisis. And it's so important. You know, I know that Iran isn't the big deal in the headlines right now, but don't you think that Max Boot and all these thugs have forgotten for a minute what they're about? They put Israel first, and that means their enmity with Iran first. But now is the chance, and I don't know what the hell is, you know, going on with Obama that he would dare to do the right thing on this at all. I do think that he's got enough on the line now that he really does mean to do this nuclear deal with Iran. And, you know, Phil Giraldi reported that, man, the deal's already worked out. CIA guys were there with William Burns in Oman ironing out the details of this agreement back late last summer. And the CIA guys were there because they were such specialist analysts that they were able to run through all of the different scenarios during the negotiations, basically in real time or every night that night, and figure out just exactly what would be acceptable for the Americans. And they basically already got the handshake, man. It's just a matter now of getting the final deal done. And then, oh man, I'm over time, damn it. And then what that means is that the biggest outstanding issue between America and Iran, their nuclear program, which is a big, fake, stupid, manufactured crisis indeed, but it would be solved. And that would be incredibly important for the short-term future of peace and freedom in the world. And so I think it's the most important thing of all, and I'm so glad Gareth wrote this book. It could make the difference in whether this deal gets done. Anyway, see you guys tomorrow. Thanks for listening.